It's time for Twig This Week in Google. We've got a great show for you. Stacey Higginbotham is here. Mike Elgin visiting from Mexico City. And, of course, that prompted a deep discussion about the merits of mole. Then we'll talk about Google's new Stadia gaming streaming gaming system and why it might not be all it's cracked up to be. And then Devin Nunes, his mother, and his cow. It's all coming up next on Twig.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twig, This Week at Google, episode 500, recorded Wednesday, March 20th, 2019. Name your child Fester. This Week at Google is brought to you by ExpressVPN. Protect your online privacy with one click. Yeah, it's that easy. For an extra 3 months free with a one-year package, go to expressvpn.com/twig. And by Thousand Eyes. Companies that run in the cloud rely on Thousand Eyes. It's the place they go first to see, understand, and improve the digital experience of their cloud-based applications and services. Do the cloud right and improve services for your customers and employees today. Visit thousandeyes.com/twit. It's time for Twig, This Week in Google. And finally, there's a lot of Google stuff to talk about. Jeff Jarvis is lost somewhere in the snowdrifts of Denver, Colorado. But Mike Elgin's here filling in from him. It's great to have Mike always. Longtime friend Twit. And I probably don't even need to introduce him. But remember Elgin.com, GastroNomad.net, where they do these great trips around the world. And Mike is a gastronomad himself, the peripatetic Mike Elgin. You're at home, though, right now.
I'm in Mexico City right now.
Oh!
This is Mexico City. Yes, we arrived last night, so
nice.
We're here in Taco Town.
Now, I don't think they appreciate being called...
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm pretty sure they don't go for Taco Town.
Well, they
have tacos.
They do. I personally think tacos is the greatest food in the world,
I
think Mexico City has the greatest tacos in the world. So it's my highest compliment for a city to call it Taco Town.
No burritos, because that's, I think, an American. No. Yeah.
I like Austin tacos.
Yeah.
What are they? What's different about them? Is that the...
breakfast.
We have all kinds of tacos. We have tacos from Mexico City. We have tacos from interior Mexico. We stick everything in a taco.
What I'm thinking plantains or southern Mexico, that kind of thing. What's a typical Mexico City taco? By the way, that's Stacey Higginbotham of Stacey on IoT and the Stacey on IoT podcast with Kevin Toeffel. Sorry, I wanted to introduce you before we get into this.
Meat and onions and cilantro. Yes.
Ooh, yum. That's all you need. Is that about right?
Well, to answer your question, the great thing about Mexico City is that all of the different regions are represented here. And in addition to modern regions of Mexico, you also have a lot of ancient Aztec and Olmec foods that are just completely amazing. Most of the every country has a food region or two they like to brag about. And here in Mexico, it's southern Mexico. It's where all the great stuff is coming from. But
I agree.
But there's just so much incredible variety, and layered on top of all of that regional variety. Well, it has to be said that Texas and California Mexican food are considered legitimate variants of Mexican food here in Mexico City as well.
That's
but
good.
Layered on top of all of that, you have this revival in the food business with, you know, hipsters creating, like, experimenting with a lot of different things. One of our favorite taco places, they put goat cheese and avocado and things like that. It's just really fantastic. And it's just a great foodie city all around.
Wait, are you eating any mole? Because in Mexico City, I would be doing, like, the mole sampler all day long.
Stacey, I'm bathing in it. And
that's an Aztec invention. Chocolate's an Aztec invention.
It's actually a little more recent than that. The Aztecs used a lot of chocolate. But they didn't use it in a sweet variety or in a sauce like that. But it was kind of like it came in the last few centuries. But there's so much innovation in mole. It's just mind-blowing. And yes, we eat tons of it.
My understanding is mole is not just a particular sauce, but it's a mix of ingredients. It's kind of like gravy, how we would, like, is that?
Yeah.
We, We go and we do on the Gastronome Man Mexico City experience. We do this essentially it's a chili class where we're mm-hmm. learning about chili, but we also do this go into mole in multiple ways. And one of the moles that we try, it actually has 130 something ingredients.
Mm-hmm.
One of which is cookies. There's this style of cookies that they actually grind up and put in the mole. So that's sure. like that cookies, multiple ingredients itself. But that's made by this woman who's like she's an older woman who lives in a village where they grow this very rare kind of chili, and she once in a while comes to Mexico City and teaches chefs 3-day class on how to make her mole. The entire 3 days is just about her mole, and we get to eat it, and it's really 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 incredible. We also go to Puyol, which is probably Latin America's best restaurant, and they have their what do they call it? They have a 5-year-old mole.
Why didn't I know about this?
Yeah. Well, they serve you a plate, and they put the 5-year mole in a circle on the plate, and then they put a new mole in on
Damn
top
it,
of it.
Damn it, man. I could be there next week.
They give you tortillas. Come on, Stacey. Seriously, we had somebody who postponed the Mexico City experience, and they're going to come later. We have a room for you. Come on down. Seriously.
When is the Mexico City event?
It's next week.
Next week.
I'm going to Finland. They don't have nearly the good food.
They don't have mole in Finland. Come on.
I know.
Mole. Wow.
Yeah.
5 years old mole. Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, I could come down for the 26th.
Come on
then
down.
I have to fly out Tuesday morning to Helsinki. Bugger.
Sounds like a trip.
Sounds like it. You should do it.
Bring your daughter and bring everybody.
She's in Spain. So
she's in Spain?
Yeah, she's in Spain.
Wow.
Everyone's cool places except for me.
No, you're in Austin. That's a cool place.
I'm always in Austin.
So let's change the subject for something Stacey's intensely interested in.
Oh.
To something she couldn't care less about.
Queso.
Gaming. Stadia.
Why am I on this show? All I do is talk about food. I don't understand. All right.
You know, Stadia. I don't mind this turning into a food show. I totally am behind that.
Queso and chips with Stacey.
Yay.
Okay. Sorry. Let's talk.
That's the title of this episode, as a matter of fact. So you better get some queso talk in there pretty darn quick. Stadia, which we covered the event yesterday at the Google spoke at the Gamers Developers Conference, GDC, Game Developers Conference, and announced their streaming gaming service. Well, announced is a big word for what they did because they left out a few critical elements like time it will be released sometime this year, cost, we don't know, nor do we know what games will be on it, except it looks like there might be a version of Doom. However, there were a lot of interesting technical features, and I think for GDC, that's probably why they were talking about it there. They want to get developers on board. We talked a little bit about Microsoft has a similar streaming plan for next year. And we were talking about it on Windows Weekly today. And really, Microsoft is in a much better position from a gamer's point of view. Already they have a reputation because of the Xbox as a gaming company. But also they have a ton of titles. Google doesn't own any gaming titles. They're going to start a Google Studio. And so it's unclear what games you'll be able to play. On the other hand, the idea that you could play a high quality, AAA title, perhaps on your Chromebook, on your Android phone, and best of all, on a Chromecast Ultra hooked up to your TV using a controller made by Google, that's an intriguing possibility.
Yeah, and it has to be said, so first a little ice water on anybody who's excited about this. They announced something very similar to this 3 or 4 years ago, and it was going to be based around Google Plus, and then the Google Play Store. Now it's primarily a function of YouTube, and Vlad Savov has a really good piece in The Verge today talking about how this is really about saving YouTube more than beating Microsoft.
Why do they need to save the most successful video platform?
Because this whole world of gamers, remember that PewDiePie started as just a guy who put a camera on himself while he was playing video games.
That's right.
And so there's a lot of video gaming stuff that is put is posted on YouTube after the fact, but Twitch is a kind of a scary thing. It's live. There's some live gaming going on YouTube, but that's kind of the future. And I think Google sees the ability to stream directly and integrate YouTube as a way to make it super compelling for the really high-end gamers who want to stream and do that sort of thing. They also love when there are products and services that require massive data center power because they excel in that area. They want people spending more time on the internet, not on consoles or using local files and stuff like that. Their whole sort of business model is to get people streaming from the cloud. And so this is a very Googly thing in lots of ways. But I have to also say a couple of points. One about as a nomad, as a digital nomad, this is like the greatest news ever because, you know, my kids are playing Xbox constantly and I can't, you know, when I'm traveling, I'm not going to travel with an Xbox, even though my younger son has done that. So I'm just like, I can't play these games. They're playing these massive multiplayer online games. And I'm just like, oh, that's nice. I don't have any ability to do that. With this, I should be able to do that in most cases if I can find the internet speeds. And it's not just nomads who don't want to buy a console, don't have the space for a console, et cetera. It's great. It's going to be great, probably, to play these kind of AAA games on a phone, a tablet, Chromebook, or whatever. It's also a great thing for Chromebooks in general because they've optimized this thing for Pixel. Remember, they sort of beta tested the Assassin's Creed game for a while with select Pixel users. I actually signed up for it immediately but couldn't play it because I was in Italy or something. It was only for U.S. users, I think. So that's really cool. Regarding the Microsoft being way ahead, I don't really necessarily think that they are way ahead. Microsoft is way ahead in terms of gaming titles, but I think Microsoft has a long way to go before they could stream them and essentially deliver them to people who don't have the console, who don't have an Xbox sitting there.
Maybe they could do it, but they may not be incented to since they make consoles and PCs.
Right.
That may not be their business model, but they certainly have Azure Cloud.
And, yes.
You know, I mean, you've got three big players here with big cloud services, Microsoft, Google, and Amazon. All three mm-hmm. have a foot in this space. Amazon yeah. owns Twitch, so they very much have a foot in this space.
Right.
I don't think that this is just Google saying, here's what we'd like to do. There's no...
Yeah.
No.
Having said that, I mean, I think they could do something. It's not going to be as good as that what they showed for a long time.
Yeah.
I mean, that was a demo.
Well, it also ignores a critical factor that's out of Google's control, which is the last mile. And,
yeah.
Some people have a great experience. People with great bandwidth and low latency will have a great experience. And then the vast majority of Americans will have a terrible experience. And yeah. Now, Stacey, there is something that you are into that this is relates to is I imagine some of this is the hope that 5G will solve that last mile problem for more people. But oh, that's a long way off, right?
Well, yeah, and it's not going to be okay. Depending on how 5G works, you're going to have it convert to Wi-Fi in your house. I'm trying to think logistically because the massive spectrum that we're going to use for fixed wireless 5G service, to get the capacity they need, you're going to need a lot of megahertz. You're going to be using some of those upper gigahertz spectrum. That doesn't penetrate walls. So you're going to have something outside your house that's going to funnel that into your Wi-Fi network. So logistically, that's what that's going to look like.
But also, I'm sure Google wants to see people doing this on an Android device out and about, too, if you had the bandwidth.
Yeah, but
honestly, there's about 18 players in this, including some non-big companies. And frankly, this was tried years ago. A company called OnLive did this.
Yeah.
And the problem OnLive had was that they didn't have enough servers because there was a lot of use during peak hours and very little use during off hours. And they didn't want to keep all those servers online. This is a problem Google will not have.
Maybe Google's doing this to get a killer app for its gigabit internet, and I know it doesn't want to do fiber anymore, or the fiber kind of faltered.
That's the big question. Like, if you knew you were going to do this, wouldn't you have pushed fiber harder?
Well, I mean, the investors didn't want them to push that harder. Right. And they also ran into technical troubles in the way they were doing it. They did it in a very googly way, which was they were like, we will build the fiber loops around cities. That is our plan. And we will invent a new technique. And then that didn't work out so well. So they were like, we will try something else. Right. And that didn't work out well. And then they were like, never mind.
And by the way,
they also were not getting the subscribers. That's the other thing.
Right. When I talk to real users like my wife, what always comes up now when Google announces something new is, well, how long before they kill that? Google has really created a reputation, and not just with geeks, but with real world people Inbox just went under, right? Of just killing things kind of randomly, and that doesn't help. So that's why I think Microsoft has a huge head start. They're already in the gaming space. They're in it to stay. They could have killed Xbox a long time ago when they struggled against PlayStation, but they didn't. They have a lot of titles. They have a studio. Google's announced a studio, but they haven't announced any titles or even, you know, all they have is Jade Raymond, who is a legend in the business. She's running the studio, but they've got to convince developers to develop games for this non-existent service. If you think end users have to take a leap of faith, developers have the same problem. You mean I'm going to develop a game for this service? Who knows if it'll launch? And if it does, who knows how long it's around? If I'm a developer, I say, I'm going to stick with Sony and Microsoft. Thank you very much.
I really think they will be and should be a different set of games, because the sort of the best, greatest hits Xbox games are always going to be better on PlayStation, Xbox, et cetera, on consoles.
And PCs, by the way. Steam on PCs is going to totally dominate that. But
totally.
So this is not going to appeal to anybody who already has an Xbox or PlayStation or a gaming PC. It's going to appeal primarily to people who don't have any gaming hardware right now.
It's going to improve casual gaming.
Yeah.
For casual gamers. And so
that's not how Google was pitching it, though, yesterday. No, it felt like they were going after the AAA titles.
Yeah, but I'm sure that they will exist. But if you really are into gaming, you're not going to want to do that streaming. And there's going to be latency. There will be latency, and it's going to vary based on a whole bunch of things. This, by the way, is another kind of punch in the nose to rural users who always get shafted in terms of
one more thing you can't world. Do.
Exactly. So it's really problematic on that score. However, I can see up and coming game companies or innovative game companies or even the big game companies developing games, optimizing them for streaming, not just converting old titles to streaming, but optimizing games. And so hopefully I'd like to see it become a new, look at the difference between console gaming and smartphone games. They're night and day. I mean, for the most part, the most popular games on smartphones are not the console style games. They're more like word games and, silly cartoony type, get your mind off of, you're standing in line at the DMV type of distraction games.
I was playing that game the other day.
yes. But I'd love to see streaming games sort of occupy the space between,
I have to point out, though, there is one AAA title that people play on consoles, they play on PCs, and they play just as avidly on mobile devices, and that's Fortnite. And I think that, truthfully, Google's prayer is that they can get the next Fortnite. One of the things they talked about was a battle royale Fortnite-style game with 1,000 players. They talked about cooperative gaming that they can do uniquely well because the servers are co-located, high-end gaming hardware next to each other. And so you at home can play a cooperative game and everybody can have a different device, for instance. And the latency between game instances is zero. So I think that's what Google's just crossing their fingers for. Who knows? Maybe they have something in development. The problem is you can create something. Doesn't mean it's going to be as successful as a Fortnite. But if that could be the make it or break it for Stadia is just some game that you can only play on Stadia that everybody in the world wants to play. And, they do have a game kind of like that with Pokemon Go. Harry Potter Wizards Unite's going to be like that. They need a title that just takes the world by storm, and then
they need to get lucky.
They need luck. That's probably the best way to say it. They need to get lucky.
Yeah.
Here's what we asked a 14-year-old gamer, Karsten Bondi's son Zach. Karsten asked him what he thought, and he said one. He talked about the beginning where CEO Sundar Pichai took the stage and said, "I'm not a gamer." He said, "It's incredibly dumb to start off your gaming presentation with your CEO saying the words, 'I'm not a gamer.'" I kind of agree. And I have to say, that's an excellent point. It doesn't set the stage. Gamers are looking at that going, "Well, screw you." Number two, why did they announce a gaming system without any games? Even the one game they said they were going to have, a Doom update, they never showed any gameplay from. During the keynote, they confirmed Doom, which is already playable on literally anything. This is Zach's thought. Literally playable on anything that even vaguely resembles a computer, including, by the way, there's Doom versions for the Apple Watch and the iPod. They have no exclusive games. The only first-party title Google has ever launched. Do you know what it is? It's the one Sundar Pichai said is the most played game of all time. The dinosaur game, which you get when you get a 404 on a website.
That is awesome.
And by the way, you can't play it on Stadia because your internet would be down. And Zach is smart, Karsten. Let me know when he's old enough for us to hire him. Number three, if your system is dependent on an internet connection, it looks really bad when your announcement live stream glitches out twice in an hour and you don't even bother to fix it in your YouTube video. So this is what he's talking about, and we noted this when we were watching the event. Everybody saw that. And by the way, first of all, the cameraman's butt is in the shot. It's frozen and glitched, and this was for everybody watching it. They didn't even bother to edit that out of the announcement on YouTube. 1.3 million people said, "Well, if that's how good it is, I ain't playing it." That happened several times. So if you can't stream a video, you can't. How are you going to stream a game? So Zach concludes, maybe the dinosaur game will be playable on Stadia after all. Final judgment, worst game system announcement ever. But I knew that. In fact, I even said, Karsten, I don't know if you remember this, during the event, I said, I could tell you right now, I can hear the hate from the gaming community, who are notoriously fickle anyway and are quick to jump on anything they feel is not, you know, whatever, game-ish. But that's not who this is for. This is not for current gamers, I don't think. I don't think that's the goal. But the question is, if for anybody? And we know it's not for Stacey Higginbotham.
Nope. I don't game. I mean, I'm excited from a technical perspective. Like,
you've never, like, on your phone played, like, Scrabble or anything?
I used to play Words with Friends way back in the day.
That's a game.
Well, yeah, and I play board games. I don't play games on my computer. I played Myst a long time ago.
You're not a gamer. Have you played the dinosaur game?
I've seen people playing the dinosaur game. Does that count?
Yeah.
See, there's a teacher.
If my internet's down, gaming. I go read a book.
So it's so funny because there really is, and I am very guilty of this, but there really is a reality distortion field in these keynotes, and I always have to kind of pinch myself, slap myself on the wrist while I'm watching them, because they're always, you know, if they're well done, they're exciting, and you watch them and you go, this is great, I can't wait to get this. And then as you get farther and farther from the event and the real questions seep in, you start to realize maybe that's not so great.
Yeah,
this is a good example of that.
Potentially great. I mean, really is.
It's all potential.
It's just that you know, on the same week when they're closing Google Plus and Allo, it's kind of hard to be like, yes, I'm all in. I'm doing this all the way, man. This is like the greatest. This is the future. Well, maybe it will be the future. Maybe it won't. Probably won't. So, you know, Google's really, you know, I am surprised that they don't do a better job of explaining this whole reputation. They act like they don't have the reputation that they clearly have of closing things that their most passionate users care about. That's the thing. They don't close nobody cares about the boring stuff, but like they build up all these passionate users around Inbox or Google Reader. people are super into it, and then they kill it. And then they create another thing, and they get all these passionate users, and then they kill it. So it's like nobody trusts Google anymore to not kill things. And that's really hurting them, and they never talk about it.
The only, come to think of it, the only counterexample to this reality distortion field that Steve Jobs perfected of, you know, so exciting in the announcement and then a little bit less overwhelming is Samsung, that does the worst announcements.
Yeah.
But I have to say now, having used the S10 Plus for a week and a half, the more I use it, the more I love this phone. This phone is awesome.
If they had done it on purpose, it would have been brilliant to lower expectations and have everybody be delighted with the reality. Yeah.
Well, Google has learned the Steve Jobs way, and it was an exciting announcement. I hope they get the. I hope they succeed. I would love it if I could play games on my Pixelbook or on my Chromecast. I mean, that would be really great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would love it. I would really love it. In fact, I occasionally go looking for Xbox style games that I can play, and I inevitably give up and just be like, well, I guess that's not going to happen. Yeah.
Does your Chromecast support?
Go ahead.
No, does Chromecast, the new one, it supports 5 gigahertz Wi-Fi?
Yes.
Okay.
The Ultra.
The tablet one.
The Ultra. Okay. The Ultra, which is, I think, $80 or $90, is 4K, HDR, 60 frames a second, and 5G.
Okay.
Yeah. It does not have an Ethernet jack, however, so you will want to use the 5G, obviously.
For 60 frames per second, that's not awesome for gaming.
No, it's enough though.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's sufficient.
It's
when has a gamer ever been like, this
is. No, you're right though. Often gamers, you know, are talking about frame rate. I think less so now maybe, but, they often talk about frame rate. 60 is plenty. That looks real. Scooter X says it does have Ethernet. Is there a dongle that comes in the box? Maybe that's why I don't remember Ethernet on mine. Maybe there's a USB dongle. I guess that sounds right. So if it has Ethernet, that's even better.
Yeah.
In the power adapter. Okay. Oh, yeah. I guess I do remember that. Mine's been sitting behind my TV for so long. It's got a thin layer of dust on it. I don't really remember unboxing it even. All right. Well, if it has Ethernet, that's pretty good. All right. I think we said it all, which is ironic. I thought we'd spend a lot more on this subject. But I think that there's just so much unknown that there's really not much more to say, except it's all potential. Our show today brought to you by ExpressVPN. I am an ExpressVPN fan. I found my VPN, folks. And if you've been looking, you might have found it too. ExpressVPN. Look, there are two reasons why people use a VPN, virtual private network. That's the thing that encrypts your internet traffic from your computer to the VPN server. Eventually, it has to enter the public internet, but why should it be visible in the open Wi-Fi coffee shop or at the hotel or even to your internet service provider? Why should AT&T get your data, right? We know they don't what they do with it. They sell it. Even your home internet service provider often sells what you do online to third parties. So people are using VPNs more and more often. There is an important distinction, though, between a good VPN and a bad VPN. There are many, many bad VPNs out there. First of all, always before you buy a VPN, read the privacy policy. When you see ExpressVPN's privacy policy, you'll note they don't log anything that you're doing. They don't keep track. They don't know who you are. You are completely anonymous. And by the way, they don't operate in the United States. They're offshore. So they don't have to respond to a subpoena from the U.S. government. This is secure. This is the best way to protect your online privacy. It secures and anonymizes your browsing by encrypting your data, hiding your public IP address. You can operate in any country. They have servers all over the world. I think it's 160 different servers. That's good for two reasons. One, because you can emerge into the public internet in the country of your choosing, but also because there's a server close to you. So that means your performance is going to be better. And I'll tell you, most of the time when you're using ExpressVPN, you won't have any idea you're on a VPN. Easy to use. They've got apps that run seamlessly in the background on Windows, Mac, iOS, Android, phone, tablet, anywhere you are. Open the app, click once, and you're protected for less than $7 a month. ExpressVPN, number one VPN service rated by Tech Radar. comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, so there's no reason not to try it right now. And in fact, we're going to give you 3 extra months free with a 1-year package at expressvpn.com/twig. Don't compromise on security. Don't compromise on privacy. And don't compromise on speed. expressvpn.com/twig. 3 extra months with a 1-year package. expressvpn.com/twig. And we thank them so much for their support this week in Google. So the third shoe has dropped. Things come in threes. The third fine from the EU for Google. This, the smallest fine, only a mere 1.49 billion euros, about $1.7 billion. And while Google stopped doing this almost immediately, so they don't have to make any agreements about not doing it anymore, it was a fine for limiting how some websites could display ads sold by others than Google's ad services, if that makes any sense. I don't know if it's over now. I don't know if Google's going to dispute this. I think they're just going to pay it because, A, it's not all that much money, and, B, they've stopped doing it.
Yeah, they're just, I caught your conversation on Windows Weekly about this, and I think that's exactly right. They have so much money. They know these things are going to happen, especially in Europe, so they just pay the fine, make the changes that they have to make.
Just the cost of doing business. Yeah.
Yeah. And so this is for, companies that were using their search for internal search. And, essentially Google was hogging the best spots for advertising and trying to exert control over what sorts of advertising could happen by the website. And so it was a little bit abusive. I personally think it's kind of a borderline abuse. I don't think it doesn't bother me that much. I mean, they're not charging for the service, and it's voluntary. So on the part of the companies, but they are so dominant in Europe. I always remind people of this. They're far more dominant in Europe than they are in the United States. And so Google is a sore subject in Europe because they are so popular, basically. So this is also, by the way, is the smallest of the big three fines. It's not a lot of money for Google. No. It's just the cost of doing business in Europe.
It's not the end, however, of possible action or charges or fines. This
for sure.
This is the chart from the European Commission. There are actually 5 probes. 3 of them have been completed. The comparison shopping was the first. The misuse of Android was the second. And then this most recent one, advertising. Google has appealed the first two, has not yet appealed, and probably won't appeal, I think, this one. And then there are 2 more probes ongoing with regard to local search and maps and scraping. And charges have not been filed. The probes are going on, but charges are not. So
what
Google's
is,
not
what
out
is
of the
scraping?
Woods.
I know what scraping is. I don't know what it is in context of Google.
I don't
is
know.
It?
Probably, I'm going to guess it has to do, and this is a pure guess, but it has to do with snippets. It's that like Zungzichrecht, where Google puts snippets of content from the sites, the news sites that it shows research results. I'm guessing. This is from a Wall Street Journal article, and I don't think they even explain what those other two probes are. So I'll have to do some research. I apologize.
And I think this one's been going on for a while, a couple, 3 years or something like that. If I'm not mistaken.
Google stopped doing this in 2017.
Well, this one, but in terms of the scraping, I think that they've been looking at that for a long, long time. And so I think I don't know why it's taken them so long other than it's the EU.
And they're maybe hoping that Article 13 that's the scraping one, that might take care of it. I don't know. And it's controversial, as you know. France and Spain have both acted against snippets. Germany has too, with less than stellar results. So, anyway, just an update. Google has also, in an attempt to assuage the European Union, decided to do a browser ballot, kind of like Microsoft did in Windows, for EU Android devices. Instead of automatically getting Chrome and Google search on your Android device, when you first set up an Android device, Google will let you choose which browser and which search engine you want to use. This is the Microsoft Windows browser ballot, which is just so stupid. Mm-hmm. And by the way, this isn't even all the browsers. It went on and on and on.
Right.
And it was a random mix in a random order. So Google, we don't have an image of Google's browser ballot and how they're going to do it. But that, they've already decided that that might be the way to do it. I have to think. I just imagine at the meeting they said, good. We'll put a ballot on the Android phone. See how they like that.
We'll show them. Yeah, I mean, all this essentially, this is a repeat of the Internet Explorer bundling antitrust thing in the 90s, which was, nobody talks about it like this, but essentially Microsoft's point was proved correct.
Yes. I mean,
basically what Microsoft was saying is that anybody can choose any browser. We're like one great browser away from being crushed, and then Firefox came along and crushed them, and then Chrome came along and crushed Firefox. So the bundling doesn't matter that much, and offering a choice has practically no effect whatsoever.
Plus, you have to have a browser. It's an integral part of any operating system, if nothing else, to give you a way to download a browser.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. Right. How are you going to download Chrome if we don't put a browser on there?
It's the only time I use Safari is when I get my new MacBook and I'm like, boom, Safari to Chrome.
April is Google. Mike is, of course, the last Google Plus user.
Yes.
Oh, April 3rd, isn't it? Is it April 3rd? Second?
It's coming up.
Yeah, I just got a thing saying save all my photos. Are you saving all your photos between Google Plus and Flickr and... What are you going to do, man?
Oh, man.
I already have all my photos, and there are multiple efforts to – so Google has its own process for downloading. I downloaded all my posts, and some of them are – I put a lot of work into, and they're very evergreen. So I'm probably going to repost them on my blog.
Good.
But we do have – I mean, like I said, I wrote in a Google Fast Company piece a couple of months ago. Most of what was great about Google Plus was killed in 2014. And so it's kind of been a shadow of itself for the last few years. So it's at this point, no big loss to a certain extent. That's a heresy in some circles. But the problem is a lot of passionate Google Plus users felt like this is the one social network I want to use. It's the only one I want to use. And all these smart people that I've gotten to know really well are here, and we have these great conversations, and everything was great. And now nobody knows where to go. Facebook's off the table because they're horrible. Twitter is annoying to a lot of people. And where else are you going to go? So people are going to, they're going to Plus Bora, and they're going to WeMe, and they're going to all these social networks nobody's heard of. But what's happening is that the Google Plus community is going off to 20 different social networks.
And so it's
diaspora.
It is a diaspora, but it's no longer, that means it's gone. It's being destroyed.
Right.
And I actually blame Google for this because they did create something of value. They really pitched it hard. A lot of people went all in. I mean, Mike, maybe it was ill-advised to put these full-length articles on Google Plus and nowhere else, but you did it because you believed in it and you really liked the conversations there. And how could Google just let that go? And this is why people no longer trust Google. They see this.
Okay. This feels like, and this drives me nuts. I mean, the web is it's no different than the rest of our lives. There are places I like to go and talk to people and hang out, and I spend my time, I put my effort in. I've worked at publications that have gone under, for example. There are coffee shops where I hang out with my friends and they are no longer around, or someone moves. The world moves on. And I know this feels really mean, but I'm kind of like, it didn't work for them. They shut it down. Okay. If you want your own stuff,
you clearly weren't a Google Plus lover.
Well, Well, I wasn't, but I've loved other things. Like, I mean, all of my GigaOm stuff, only half of it exists. I've lost my entire podcast catalog from GigaOm, and I'm like, all right.
That's life.
You know, it's life. I've got...
I'll tell you why it hurts.
I mean, it hurts, but just...
But I'll tell you why. We need something like that.
Do we, though?
Yeah, we do.
No, because then we stagnate. I mean, then you go and create other communities. You take your ideas that you learn from other people, and then we... I mean, think about it in the physical world. You know,
if there is no analog in the physical world. If there were, if there were
a thing... Towns.
There's towns. Yeah, it's like a town has disappeared. That's a big deal.
Right, but those people left that town. I'm not saying it's not a big deal. I'm saying these things happen in life, and you just have to accept it and put you down your roots somewhere else and do it all over again. And that's what people, that's life, I guess. I
understand what you're saying.
The thing that has to be said, though, is that Google Plus, the original version from 2011 to 2014, to a lesser extent afterwards, was a really, really special social network. I mean, it was really every social network, for some reason, I certainly have no idea why this is, has a certain zeitgeist, has a certain feel to it, a certain tone, a certain, you know, Instagram is so different from Twitter or Facebook, even though it's owned by Facebook. And the essential nature of Google Plus, there were things that were achieved on that social network that you just are unheard of on other social networks. One of them is lots and lots and lots of people actually turned strangers into close friends in real life. And I'm one of those people. I have 15, 20 people who I go visit and who I know personally and who I didn't know until we started following them on Google Plus. You learn you have a lot in common. You have a lot, you know, you gang up on trolls together. You do all this stuff. You do hangouts. And then they're great friends. I have people in Belgium. And like, I went and stayed with a great friend that I met on Google Plus in Switzerland. You don't hear about that kind of stuff. On Facebook, basically, what you're doing is you're kind of hoovering up all of the all the friends and acquaintances and coworkers you've ever had and maintaining some superficial connection with them. On Google Plus, you're like, everybody was a stranger because nobody's family was on there really to speak of. And you make these great friends. I don't know why that was the case. We used to have these things called hurls, hangouts in real life, essentially meetups. And I've never heard of a social network that was so conducive to real-world friendships.
People had, in the early days of Twitter, and it stopped soon, but in the early days of Twitter, there were tweet-ups, and it was very much like that. But Twitter became mass appeal, and that ruined it. And I think one of the reasons Google Plus was great is because it wasn't very successful.
And exactly.
The people who were there were great. But are there lessons to be learned from this?
Google can't do social, no matter how
That's
much.
I would submit. I will not. I think we need to have. I don't think we can trust any company to do this right.
Get a WordPress blog and do it yourself.
Well, but that's not social. Ultimately, it's only a little bit social. I mean, honestly, and it's been tried, and this is so. I know my solution isn't a good solution, but we need a federated, open network that, and you know, we had hopes that, you know, Identica, then StatusNet, then Mastodon would be that. They have the right backbone, but somehow those communities never gelled properly. But that's how it has to be, because if a company's in charge of it, all sorts, A, they could kill it, but B, they start monetizing. Instagram was a great site, great social network, until they put an ad every ninth post, and they started adding all these features like stories and the influencer. As soon as the influencers arrived, Instagram went way downhill.
What about something like Pinterest?
Yeah, maybe Pinterest is the answer. I don't know.
I mean, it's a high quality. Is it very social?
Feels more like people put stuff there, but there doesn't feel like there's interaction.
Yeah.
As much,
yeah.
Right. It's a
scrapbook. Maybe that's the problem. It's where people interact become cesspits. That's not a crazy idea.
I keep wishing Mastodon would succeed because from a technical point of view, it's the right thing. Nobody owns it. It's federated. You can create your own server.
But the communities that have been created on Mastodon, I haven't found one that really attracts me at this point.
Yeah. The problem is that every social network is either a failure, in which case it's not worth using because nobody's on it.
Yeah.
Or if it's successful, they will ruin it in order to squeeze every nickel out of it.
That's why it can't be commercial.
Those are the only two social networks we've ever seen. Google Plus was different for a while. I mean, people say it wasn't popular, and I mean, it's way more popular than lots of other social networks that have emerged since that people think are popular.
It had great features, though. Like, unlike Mastodon, which really is a Twitter clone, it was a threaded conversation clone. It was great with images. People like Trey Ratcliffe showed that it became a fabulous place to put your images. Google mismanaged it almost from day one, establishing this crazy circle system that no one wanted to maintain. And then, you know, I mean, they killed it death by a thousand cuts. And it's tragic, and it's a really good example of why Google or any company shouldn't be in charge of social, and yet no one's done any. I wish they, you know what Google,
Slack?
Open source. Yeah, Slack people has turned into that. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean,
maybe that's it.
And you know what? I would say we had the former Giga Omers, we actually had, we took our Slack channel
right
at the end of the show or at
is
the end
still
of the
alive?
Company.
You still do
it? It actually still is alive. Yeah. And for the year afterwards, we actually even paid for our own private Slack. And we did it because we had a lot of value in it. And
Slack's such a pig as an application. It's hard to support it. It's just a terrible, it's written in Electron and it's just big and heavy.
It's
not bad. I mean, and I know people are doing it. Discord is another very popular social network.
Can I propose, I have to say something.
Yes.
About
let me just say this before you do, which is Google, please open source Google Plus and let us take it back. Okay.
The tragedy is that we already have the world's greatest social network, which is email. And the reason that nobody wants to use email for social networking is because they've lost control of their inboxes. Lots and lots of people have 20,000 messages in their inboxes, and because they can't manage the spam and the hype and the thing, the newsletters and all that stuff, they're like, yeah, let's all go to Slack. This is the prevailing attitude, but it's mistaken. Everybody goes to Facebook, for example, because for a bunch of reasons, but the number one reason is network effects. Everybody's on Facebook because everybody's on Facebook, except everybody isn't on Facebook. Email, there are three or four times as many people on email.
Everybody
than
is on
Facebook.
Email. Yeah.
Everybody's on email.
It's a terrible social experience.
I agree.
In what way exactly?
That's like saying chain letters are awesome for social experience.
But in what way is it? It's exactly what Leo's talking about. It's an open system. You can use your own front end. You can use this, that, the other thing.
But you can't communicate easily with people. You can't see it. The conversations, when they're threaded the way email threads them, are horrible. You can't.
Maybe it's just we need a better client.
Maybe
the client could
solve. That's exactly right.
No, because then you would still split your email. So then you would just take your email identity, but you still have to split them out. Like, I don't want to communicate with my friends over email because
Inbox does a
that's a professional.
Inbox, there you go. There's a solution. Why don't we?
The one they're killing. Oh.
That's dead. Okay.
Rats.
Well, my point is that email is so close. You mentioned the threaded. I mean, you probably use Gmail. The threading of message threads on Gmail and inbox is not great, but it could be. It should be. It should be something that is fixable in the client. But it's a great social network because you can't. There's no algorithmic filtering. And then the truth is, this is one of the reasons people hate it. Because somebody like Facebook, there's not some corporation monitoring your relationships and deciding who's important and who isn't important.
Anybody can email me. Yeah.
People say they don't like that, but actually people love that fact that Facebook is simply not showing you what people are posting.
And so, I mean, everyone, there's too much information if there's no algorithm. I mean, I have 17,000 unread emails in my inbox. This does not stress me out.
But again, that's handleable in the browser. I mean, there's no reason why you couldn't algorithmically sort emails, other than the fact that you also have mission critical business that's coming into the same box.
Exactly. And that's the dog against, or dog, that's the mark against email, I guess.
Well, this is one of the interesting things that happened when I got off Facebook. Well, I mean, I haven't gotten off yet. 4th of July is when I'm officially getting off. In the meantime, I'm sort of criticizing them like every day, and also trying to get people to sign up for my newsletter and go to my nice book. My nice book is a folder on Google Photos where I post personal photos and where people can comment and like those photos. And it's a kind of replacement for Facebook. But what I've noticed is I already have lots of family and friends who were not on Facebook before. And so they never saw my personal photos. Now that I'm on Google Photos, they see it because they get a notification in their email inbox. And so they use an email, but they didn't use Facebook. And so now for the first time, there are several older relatives of mine who are seeing my personal photos for the first time. But again, this is a way, this is back to the promise of Google Plus. Google Plus promised to integrate Gmail and Google Plus. So email, social networking was all kind of the same thing.
And photos, by the way.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And so now I'm sort of email and photos is the same thing, unless you choose to get notifications on your phone or whatever. Some people do both, but a lot more people are seeing my personal photos on Google Photos than we're seeing them on Facebook.
Developer should just reverse engineer all the best features of Google Plus, Google Photos, and email, and make something. There's an opportunity here. I think a lot of people are going to be leaving Facebook. Here's why I think it's sad, Stacey, because I think we need a good social network. We clearly like social networks, but we also see the downsides to social networks. Is it impossible to design a social network that really works? Maybe we just haven't tried enough times.
I think the problem is there's not one social network that's going to work for everyone.
Right.
And that the challenge then becomes, oh, well, if everyone's not on it, then I can't reach everyone. Thus, people are like, oh, this is not the right social network. And then we get frustrated. I mean, the things I want in a social network are probably very different than the things Mike wants in a social network, I would guess, since he is such
a... I think a well-designed app could probably handle both.
Maybe it could handle the difference between Mike and me, but could it do Mike, me, plus my mom and my daughter?
I'm sure it could. Why not?
I don't think it would be as essential. Like, I think at different points of your life, you want different things. I think you communicate different ways with people depending on the type of person you are, the type of interaction you're seeking. I mean, I don't think there's one for everyone in even every stage of your life.
I do think that there's a general idea that most people would love in a social network. So the problem, I think most of the problems with social networking, especially Facebook, is inauthenticity. So I would, and I mean that very broadly. So for example, when my uncle Fester posts some meme he found, I have no interest in that.
I don't see why.
Yeah.
Wait, do you really have an Uncle Fester?
No, I do not.
Oh,
I wish I did.
My,
yeah, I wish I did.
Somebody needs to start naming kids Fester so that down the road, there'll be a future world in which people will have an Uncle Fester.
Yes. Please, you young parents out there, please
name
your child Fester.
You're not doing it for him. You're doing it for the future generation.
That's right. Think of the future. But I think that and so that ranges from people passing around memes or other people's thoughts to Russian interference to, disinformation campaigns to.
But that was the beauty of Google Plus. You could filter that stuff out.
Well, over time, it people were sharing stuff that's not their own thoughts. But I would love a social network that had basically two rules. One is, no algorithmic sorting or filtering. When I follow somebody, I want everything they post.
Yep.
Second thing is Nobody, I don't want to get any content that isn't the actual words or photos taken by the person that I follow.
No share, no resharing, no retweeting.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I don't mind retweeting, but if that does,
I do that with TweetDeck. I turn off retweets, and it really cleans the Twitter stream considerably because you don't get this amplification effect.
Yeah, but you know that even with back when before social network working, one of the big problems we had on email was everybody sending these these
forwards,
chain letters, and and they were all that was fake news of the 2005 or whatever, but.
It continues to this day, by the way. There's plenty of relatives who continue to send those.
And another thing that this fantasy social network should have is the ability to bring in content that follows the rules from other social networks. So if somebody wants to be on Twitter and I can just plug in Twitter and have their tweets coming to this social network and then my comments go back out to Twitter. But again, companies like Twitter are going to they're going to strangle that in its cradle.
If Kevin Marks were here, he would say this is the kind of thing the open web is, indie web is constantly working on. And there are a lot of initiatives and a lot of attempts to kind of solve these technical challenges. But I've tried a lot of them. I play with them all because I want to. I'm looking for this one thing. There is one tool I'm going to mention because a big part of the social networking that is email is newsletters. Mike, you've got a great one. The problem I have with newsletters is that I get too many because it's not just Mike sending me newsletters. It's also Wayfair. You got what I need, and I don't want that. So, and they're all intermingled. So Megan Maroney on iOS Today found a really nice app. It's called Stoop. That's basically you subscribe to newsletters with a Stoop email address. If you sign up for Stoop, you'll get an email address. And then all the newsletters you actually want go into an app that you can read. And this really works well. This is it's a news reader for email newsletters. If it would be the elevator pitch.
And I think that's cool. It's basically this is what I roll my own for that exact same concept. What I do is I have a newsletter folder. I have a rule that basically grabs every email newsletter and puts it in that folder. And then when I'm ready to go read newsletters, I just go through them in reverse chronological order. And it's very nice to not have newsletters in my inbox next to
I do
emails
same.
From my kids or whatever. Yeah. And so it really, really works for me. And it's part of how I achieve zero inbox like several times a day. But again, this is kind of a nerdy thing that most people don't want to do. So an app like this is a great idea because it kind of does it for you.
We need the opposite of a Google change log, maybe the Google dead list or something.
Yeah, the Google graveyard.
spring cleaning. So April 2nd, and I actually there's some details to this. April 2nd, inbox is going away, and Google Plus are going away. Here is how it works. The timeline. Google's released this February 4th. Which is past, you can't create a new profile. All your web comments will be deleted on April 2nd. That's coming up. In fact, all consumer Google Plus content will be deleted. Google has said they're going to keep a business version of Google Plus around. I don't know what that means. Other than Google Notes, content that it's required to keep for legal reasons. So photos, videos, your album archive, everything is going to go away. You need to go to Google Takeout and get it all. There's also a Google support page for that. But that's not all. They're going to be Inbox and Google Plus are going away, but so is Goog.gl. Their URL shortener is going away.
Yeah.
Yay. Also, Allo.
I believe the links that exist for that will continue to work.
But you can't make new links. Wow. Yeah.
Right.
So Google is really doing some house cleaning. I can't say I'm unhappy about Inbox because I mean, it was good and I feel bad for people who relied on it, but I think there are other choices, out there. And the URL shortener, there's certainly plenty of choices there. I use Bitly for that. Google Plus has been dead for a long time. They're just pulling the cord. But I'm actually most sad about that.
Yeah. Well, the good news is that Internet Archives and the archive team are working to preserve public posts.
Thank you.
And they posted this on a Reddit, and essentially what they're doing is they're going to compress the photos, so you're not going to have the high quality photos. They're probably not going to preserve all the comments. Like I mentioned, the glory days of Google Plus between 2011 and 2014, the Google Plus messages had a maximum of 500 comments, and for many, many users, their comments were maxed out every time on every single post. So for posts that have more than, they didn't say specifically, but I would guess a few dozen comments, you're not going to retain all those comments. But they'll try to retain a screenshot, essentially, of the most of the comments or some of the comments for posts. But again, the important thing are the posts and the photos, and they're trying to retain them all. And this is the reason this is interesting, is because if you thought that, if you were wanting to delete your posts and figure, well, I'll just let Google do it for me, you really should delete them ASAP before they're archived by these guys, because this archive may live forever, actually.
Let's hope it does. It should.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then there's Devin Nunes. Hard not to be amused by this. Yeah. He's a representative from California, former chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, now ranking member. He's suing Twitter and a number of Twitter users, including his mom, his fake mom, Devin Nunes' mom, and his cow, Devin Cow, two parody accounts, for $250 million. Nunes is accusing Twitter of facilitating defamation on its platform by ignoring lawful complaints about offensive content and by allowing that content to remain accessible to the public, saying that it violated terms of service. On the other hand, it's not illegal to parody or mock people. And ironically, Devin Cow, which had fewer than 1,000 followers when this lawsuit was announced, I should go quickly check, but has gained a lot of traction.
Streisand effect.
Let me just see. Devin Cow now has 472,000 followers.
So what's frustrating here is that people have actually beat Twitter up for having terrible reactions to people saying, hey, take this down, it's offensive, it bothers me. And Twitter's constantly like women who have been, you know, yelled at on Twitter, that's a big problem they have. They see all kinds of offensive content and Twitter does nothing. So do I wish Twitter had better standards? Yes. Do I want to get behind Devin Nunes and his obvious attack on a parody account? No. Well, I'd also be really curious what Jeff would say, given his...
Yeah,
his
Jeff's had the problems, as have I, with parody accounts. I've never sued Twitter over that. If you're a public figure, especially if you're a member of Congress, you really kind of have to accept the fact that people are going to have something to say to you, and Twitter's a good place to do it.
Who told him he should sue?
Well, it was obviously bad advice. He's grown the size of Devin Cow following by 471,000.
It's the best thing that ever happened to his cow.
Oh, man,
sure.
Devin Cow is so happy.
But my favorite part about this is that he is specifically talking about libel and defamation coming up to the 2018 midterms. And the lawsuit is $250 million for compensation and an additional $350,000 in punitive damages. But like, it's like, wait a minute, back up there. $250 million in compensatory damages. He's saying that he's going to lose $250 million because of these parody accounts.
Well, I imagine that Twitter will seek a summary judgment and get it thrown out immediately. I can't imagine this will proceed, and even if it does, there's no way he's getting a penny.
But where was this money coming from?
Where is the quarter of $1 billion you lost, Devin? I mean,
was it from bribes, from campaign finance?
Turns out Devin Nunes is as bad a lawyer as he is a member of Congress. And a bad strategian as well, because, or strategician, because he, Devin Cao now has 100,000 more followers, 100,000 more followers than Devin Nunes' official account.
I think that seriously, I think what he's actually doing is that I personally have to assume that this is a publicity stunt.
Yeah, probably.
And the whole, it's basically, trying to feed the Republican narrative that social networks have an anti-conservative bias.
That's exactly what's going on.
The president's jumping on this. Everybody's jumping on this. And in interviews with various people, Jack Dorsey has pointed out that much of the time, when people say, oh, this conservative person posted some conservative opinion and you block them, he says, well, that's what you think is happening, but actually we see all the behind the scenes. What they're really doing is they're in the part of this coordinated campaign of disinformation with multiple fake accounts and bots doing all this XYZ. And the sum total of all these things that this particular instance is doing is getting them booted off. What is chilling and nauseating about all this is that there's a lot of dirty tricks in politics, and you know, you can't blame just the conservatives, but and so let's just basically point out that disinformation works and that false narratives work, and the conversations are getting so extreme and it's all being amplified by social media. Everybody's got a voice, even Nunes's cow has a voice. Everybody's got a voice, and so there's legitimate mainstream politicians are essentially trying to make the world safer for disinformation, because that's the strategy. Those are the tactics that everybody's glomming onto. If we can basically shame social networks into allowing disinformation campaigns or, you know, any of this other stuff by saying that they have a conservative bias. I mean, they've seen Facebook actually reverse course on things when they were accused of having a conservative bias. We've seen all kinds of hay being made when this particular person or that particular account has been shut down or suspended or whatever. And they just immediately just apologize and reverse course on it. So you can, you know, it's just a strategy. They're trying to increase the size of the window that's allowed for any kind of speech that harms political opponents. I think that's the problem.
If Twitter were doing what Nunes's lawsuit says, if it was actively censoring and shadow banning conservatives, thereby eliminating Nunes's voice while amplifying the voice of his Democratic detractors, so what? I mean, I don't think they are, but what if they were, so what? I'm sure you could accuse Fox News or MSNBC of having a bias and not giving a voice to people it disagrees with. If it's a media company, it's allowed to do that. What makes Twitter special that it's not allowed to have a point of view, if it does, which I don't think it does. But even if it did, that's not illegal.
Again, I don't think this lawsuit is being filed in good faith.
It's not serious.
I think it's all part.
Yeah. It's
all
like, without
it's a
merit.
Tactic. It's a tactic.
I'm sure any judge will just say, well, come on. Here's one of the tweets from Devin Nunes' mom that was mentioned in the complaint. Devin Nunes, your district is looking for you. Are you trying to obstruct a federal investigation again? You come home right this instant or no more Minecraft.
See, that's gold.
That's pretty gold. Funny. That's comedy
that's
gold.
Yes.
And even if you were a Devin Nunes fan, I think you would say, well, that's funny. It's not harmful.
Right. It's not, you know, advocating harm to another person, like some tweets.
And
that
lots of tweets
Congress
do that.
Members have tweeted.
Yeah. We've seen a lot of that.
Yeah.
And I don't see that blocked. I wish it were, but we don't see that blocked.
You can't block the president of the United States. Come on.
I know. By the way, finally, a bill has been signed into law banning fake news and internet insults, completely illegal in Russia.
Yeah, I'm so glad that somebody is standing up against fake news. It's about time.
It's about time. The bills say you can't criticize the government. Let's see. Here's the exact quote. There's punishment for spreading information that, quote, exhibits blatant disrespect for the society, government, official government symbols, constitution, or governmental bodies of Russia. See, Devin Nunes would love Russia.
You know, the U.S. did have laws like this. We had the treason and sedition law way back in the...
It was right after the First Amendment became the part of the Constitution. We passed a bill that said, oh, and by the way, don't say anything bad about the government.
So, I mean, we came back from that, thank goodness.
Yes, thank goodness.
You know, we're
actually, it's really remarkable how much the First Amendment has become almost a state religion. And I think that's a very good thing. But as you point out, historically, Stacey, it was not. It was not particularly even honored by Congress. But thank goodness it kind of is these days. And I think that's the right thing. Clearly, in Russia, there is no First Amendment. Insulting state symbols and Putin will carry a fine of 300,000 rubles and 15 days in jail for repeat offenses.
Wow. You know, in California, you can flick off a police officer and it's considered a First Amendment right now.
Yeah, that was an interesting case, wasn't it?
It's like, oh.
I wouldn't recommend it. I'm not saying as a policy, it's a good policy. But, you know, sometimes having the right to do it and actually doing it are different things.
Well, one of the fun things about President Trump, and I don't want to talk about his politics or this isn't a left-right thing, but whether you're conservative or liberal, you have to acknowledge the obvious fact that he tends to call fake news news that does not praise or that's critical of him. That's his definition of fake news. And good news is news that is praiseworthy, that praises him. Yeah. And this is essentially the law that they've enacted in Russia.
Yeah.
To a large extent. They're saying no fake news. What is fake news? Well, anything that criticizes the government is by definition fake news. And so it's absolutely ridiculous. It's also ridiculous because, of course, it has to be said that Russia is probably the world's largest purveyor of
fake
disinformation
news.
And news in the world. So
that's actually a very good point. I hadn't really thought about that. It's illegal in Russia, but you could do it against anybody outside of Russia.
It's something that Russia has been on the forefront of for 100 years. I mean, during the Cold War, the Soviet Union governed to a very large extent by using disinformation within the country. This is before globalization, all that kind of stuff. But the KGB was masterful at disinformation. And just go look at the archives. You see different versions of every photo where before Photoshop, they were, you know, hand painting people out of photos as if they never existed and so on. So they've been at this for a long, long time.
Stalin was a master.
Yeah.
Actually, the president is already campaigning for 2020 and is way outspending his Democratic opponents in ad spending on Google. In fact, most of his ad spending is on Facebook. He has already spent $3.5 million from the beginning of the year on Facebook ads, $1 million on Google. That's more than all the other candidates combined. And you know what? It worked for him. It's, I think, in a way, this shows that these other candidates haven't learned the lesson of the 2020 election. Facebook is really where the battleground is going to be, isn't it?
I think that what's happening to a very large extent is people don't want to throw a whole lot of money behind a candidate when that candidate's chances of being the nominee are very slight.
So as soon as we have a front runner, then we're going to see it ramp up.
Trump is absolutely going to be the nominee. Not necessarily, actually. After, there could be lots of news that comes out that could harm him, and the Republican Party may want to go with somebody else.
And Mitt Romney and others are saying they're running, so there may be some challenge.
Yeah. So, but still, he's a, you know, it's a pretty safe bet that you can contribute to his campaign now, and you'll be actually backing somebody who will be running, which is nice.
I think we'll be watching with real interest because I think it's pretty clear that Facebook ads are the single most effective way, right?
You think not anymore? It'll be very interesting to see how Facebook, I mean, remember, we talk about this all the time. Facebook tweaks its algorithms and 6 newspapers go out of business, or not newspapers, but news organizations.
Right.
So there's a very real chance that Facebook could adapt the way that it targets advertising or allows people to do things related to ads that changes that. And that would be very, I mean, I wouldn't count it out, I guess, is what I'm saying. Facebook could really, Facebook mm-hmm. is very, very much so a player here. As much as it may not want to be, as much as it may hate to admit it, it can do things to make its ads, make ads much more or much less effective.
Facebook getting a lot of heat, of course, for the tragedy in Christchurch. It was streamed live for 17 minutes by the shooter or the alleged shooter on Facebook. Although, do we still really have to call him the alleged shooter if he streamed the video of him doing it live? I've not seen it.
Until someone is convicted in a court of law.
Still alleged. Okay.
Alleged.
There's some pretty strong evidence, however, which he provided. I never hoped to see it, but there are a lot of people who want to see it. And, of course, the real problem all the social networks are having right now is keeping that video down. Facebook says it removed 1.5 million reposts of that video, but that several hundred thousand still got through. Twitter and Reddit and other social networks have faced it. And now in Australia, Telstra, one of the big Australian telecom companies, is actually blocking 4chan, 8chan, and other sites. They say because of these videos, but I wonder if this is going to be a long-term strategy.
No, it was temporary. They've already unblocked them again.
They have, okay. Okay.
Yeah, I think so. But it raises another question. I mean, back in the old days before social and before live streaming, I mean, we really have to, you know, we've all gotten used to live streaming, but what a revolution that is. I mean, I remember when it was first coming out, actually speaking of Google Plus, the first free way to live stream multiple people was Hangouts on Air. And it's like, you know, it's like owning CBS News or something like that, but with a larger audience, potentially, if it's, you know, and obviously that kind of power is going to be gamed by lots of people for lots of purposes, including violent psychopaths. And back in the old days, it was a kind of a common thing where crazy people would hold hostages or do some threaten violence. If you don't read my manifesto on the air, I will do XYZ. This has been going on for now. Now they don't have to do that anymore. They can go directly to the people and they can live stream their stuff, which raises the question. And this is a dicey issue because I'm saying this as we're live streaming this. But do we need live streaming? Are the potential downsides of live streaming worth the pain
and
suffering?
We can filter something like this, building filters for this that catch something of this magnitude, or even people who are trying to kill themselves over live stream. Those are things you can actually algorithmically detect. If not the content of the video, the sudden interest in a video. Facebook saying that no one apparently reported this feels like a real dodge. And I know there are 8 billion people on this planet now. Have we reached that yet? 7.5? And, you know, 3.5 of them have internet access, so they could be streaming something abhorrent at any one point in time. But I do think there is an investment that needs to be made in detecting these and getting them down faster. And it's technically very possible.
I would say even if it weren't, that's no reason to stop live video. I'm sorry. I just really feel like, I mean, it's awful, but one of the things that's so great about the internet is the elimination of gatekeepers and mm-hmm. people who were protecting us against things we didn't want to see. I think back to the Vietnam War, which was some called the first television war. And I think one of the reasons the Vietnam War was so heavily protested was because people for the first time saw the horrors of war in their living room. And I think that if you attempt to filter out the horrors of the world in a reasonable attempt to, you know, keep people safe, that's a mistake. And I don't think the gatekeepers made the world a better place. And I think, you know, this is the problem with the internet. It brings in the good and the bad right into your living room. But in the long run, I think that any restrictions on the capabilities of the internet is a big mistake.
I also worry that the Facebooks and the Googles of the world will screw this up. There have been lots of, you talked about the benefits of live streaming. Some of these have involved cases of police brutality.
Yes.
Where And it's actually a shield to a certain extent. I mean, there have been cases where people have been on the brink of being attacked in some way or violated in some way, and somebody would be like, well, this is streaming live right now. You're like, and you can't, you know, once it's in the cloud, you can't take it back. You can't delete the file or whatever. And so live streaming has a vast positive upside. However, I just hope Facebook can distinguish between violence that involves that's being streamed by a victim in order to have witnesses.
I don't think it can, and I think it's very hard. And Facebook is primarily relying on the reporting of the people who see it to take stuff down. And honestly, I think that's fine.
Well,
that's the bitter with the batter. I mean, I think you just kind of
That will be gamed. Let's say somebody on one side of the political spectrum is live streaming something that people on the other side of this political spectrum don't like. So they use their campaign methods, the same thing they do on Twitter to like attack somebody, Twitter mobs, and they get it taken down as offensive comment and content, and it's live streamed. So once they've gotten it shut down, that moment is lost. And so I worry about the incompetence of the companies,
I don't think they should be
immaturity of the technology. Yeah. And also worry about the fact that every powerful thing, whether it's live streaming or reporting objectionable live streaming, will be gamed by the propagandists, the liars, the cheaters, the everybody's.
It's unfortunate. So. And I think what we definitely want to do is prevent the glorification of a mass murderer by resharing this video. And I think that the efforts companies have made to prevent that are well, spent.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think turning off live streaming is the solution. I really think that's a technology that needs to continue.
It's not the live streaming as much as it is the radical virality. The real-time virality.
Virality is a problem. I agree. But you can't prevent it, so what are you going to do to stop virality? That's humans. See, I think a lot of times we want to legislate humanity. Mm-hmm. I guess that's what laws are, right? But
That's society's effort to control the worst impulses of human nature.
Yeah, we have them.
We're okay with that. Yeah, we're just the power of amplification is really does a lot of damage when the wrong thing is being amplified, and that's exactly what we're talking about here.
Yeah, I don't know what the answer is. I don't know.
Live in a cave and that's not the answer. I guess that's
New Zealand's decided they're going to enact tougher gun laws.
Yeah, so New Zealand is actually very proactively doing things that I think will make a difference.
Like, that's a start.
Yeah. Or you could put those videos on MySpace and probably they'd get lost forever.
Ta-da.
MySpace has lost all the music uploaded to it between 2003 and 2015 as a result of a server migration project. MySpace says any photos, videos, and audio files you uploaded more than 3 years ago may no longer be available on or from MySpace. We apologize for the inconvenience and suggest you retain your backup copies. Oops.
Have you tried Google Plus?
Oops. there's no backup. They're gone forever. This is an article from Boing Boing. Cory Doctorow, its author, will be on Triangulation this coming Monday. He's got a brand new book.
Radicalize,
yeah. His brand new book of short stories. He'll be on 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern. We love Corey. He's been on many times. In fact, I've interviewed him so many times, I said, Megan, you take this one. Because sometimes what happens if I'm interviewing somebody, and it happened with you, Mike, somebody I know really well, it just turns into a friend's conversation instead of an interview. Yeah. So I'm going to let Megan take Corey. Monday, 1 p.m. Pacific, his new book, Radicalized. He is, if you've never heard Corey speak, tune in. He is amazing. Or watch his talk at South By. He's done a lot of talks recently. His mind works 10 times faster than mine, and it's just amazing to watch him think. How's your boy Beto these days?
Raised $6.4 million.
Yep. Apparently his secret membership in America's oldest hacking group hasn't hurt him. What was his handle in the Cult of the Dead Cow? Something funny. Wasn't a very good name.
It was Psychedelic something or other. Yeah.
What was it, Carson?
Psychedelic Warlord.
Psychedelic Warlord. 53.
Yeah. President. That's President Psychedelic Warlord.
President Psychedelic Warlord to you. Honestly, haven't we been calling for somebody who knows something about technology in the Congress and the White House?
I think we actually have lots of people in Congress that know something about technology.
Good.
Not lots.
Let's get somebody in the White House.
Worries me is the conversation everybody's having. Everybody, I've had it myself. We're all having this conversation where it's like, oh, but the problem is that that his political opponents will attack him. It's the fact that a hacker, you know, if you look at his actual history, it's all very innocuous, I think, as far as we know. And it's actually, much of it is very positive in terms of learning about technology, learning how it works. But the word hacker has a negative connotation. Right. And so the propagandists, the political propagandists, will try and destroy him.
Well, he also has some
different kind of hacker.
He also has a DUI. He has other things going on. Although, on the plus side, if he got into the White House, he might replace President Nixon's bowling alley with a skate park. Which would be pretty
also,
cool.
Also, we voted Donald Trump in.
Okay. And okay.
I'm just going to shut that down right now. I mean, like, let's not.
Literally anyone can be president now, as we've proved.
I feel like, you know, we had this conversation. We're like, oh, Clinton, you know, didn't he smoke weed? Yeah, he totally did. Yeah. You know, I'm like, guys, we like took all of that and set it on fire and said, anyone, come on in.
Come on in. Yeah. Oh, he did say that. He joined the hacker group because it was, you know, like the Facebook of its day. When Dad bought an Apple IIe and a 300 baud modem and I started to get on the boards, it was the Facebook of its day. You just wanted to be part of a community.
Yeah.
So.
Hey. I don't think being a hacker has negative connotations now, does it?
I think being a skater is worse than being a hacker.
Or punk rocker.
Yeah. I mean, people don't like extremely California things. And, skating is one of them, like, you know.
Well, and he moves his hands a lot, right? What's that all about?
From all the skating, you have to, like, be balancing.
That's
all the
right.
Time, so.
That's
just
a good
an
point.
Emphatic individual.
No, we're just, yes. I'm joking, obviously.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he was a young person who is not, he was not, you know, like a lot of political candidates, you know, president of the political club and, right. You know, doing all kind of stuff.
He didn't get his calling till late in life.
So right. Remember that show, it was a movie back in like the early 80s called Gleaming the Cube? He's a combination of the computer hacker and Christian Slater skater character. That is what he is.
Love it.
And if you didn't watch Gleaming the Cube, it's because you were not a massive Christian Slater fan back in the early 80s as a teenage girl.
He's a strange fellow.
There are a lot of people who are very respectable people nowadays who were skaters, who have tattoos.
It's
all
gonna
over.
It's going to be hard to elect
drugs and do all that stuff.
I mean, things change.
Who are we gonna, I have a friend who he is just the most. I mean, if you think he was, you know, he seems like a CEO. I mean, seems like an ultra responsible person. And after a while, you learn he was actually a pro skater.
Wow.
Back in the day, and it's like, nice. Wow, that's amazing. But I think it should be a non-story. It won't be a non-story. It's right. Going to be weaponized, and it's part of the problem with our political conversation.
It's only a matter of time before we get a skater in the White House. I'm just saying.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah, maybe Avril Lavigne. I don't know. We'll be the first lady. Our time for the play the trumpets. It's time for the Google change log.
The Google Changelog.
Boom, boom, boom. It is bringing new voices and communities to the world of podcasts. Google and the PRX Podcast Garage in Boston, training independent podcasters. This is the team from Santiago, Chile. They do the Las Raras podcast, the Outsiders. This is kind of cool. They're promoting podcasts, training them. People who you know, applied, who had a podcast but wanted to learn more about how to do it at the PRX Podcast Garage, sponsored by Google. There are teams raising awareness about LGBTQ plus people's lives. It's called Afro Queer Stories from the Filipino Diaspora, Long Distance, Modern Beauty Standards, The Colored Girl Beautiful, Puerto Rican History, Time Storm, and Car Culture and Road Rage. Here's the one I'm going to be listening to. Who Taught You How to Drive? That's exciting. Thank you, Google, for supporting podcasts. If you use Google Tasks, it's really becoming an all-in-one utility. A lot of new features added to Tasks from the Google G Suite blog. Three highly requested features being added to Tasks. Not clear if this is only in G Suite or if this is for all Tasks users. It's about time. You could set a date and time for your tasks and get notifications. You can create repeating tasks and import reminders into tasks.
Isn't this self-evidently a kind of mitigation of the termination of inbox? Because one of the things that inbox had that Google, the Gmail doesn't have, is this whole super integration with reminders. And so they're basically saying, oh, we're going to kill the thing that where you have been doing most of your reminder stuff, and we're going to give you Gmail instead. But Gmail has a click a button, and there's your tasks, and there are all your reminders, thanks to this new feature. I think that's clearly what they're doing here. They're trying to find a place for the things that inbox users were loving.
Well, and it's a basic thing for a task or a reminder.
It does seem like something you should have. Yeah.
I never used Google Tasks because it sucked.
Yeah. There's so many better to-do lists out there than tasks, including Google's own Keep.
Yeah, I use Google Keep, actually, because it syncs across all my devices and I can put things in good places.
It does all those things.
Can I share a preview of something I've been working on? I'm working on a very short, I don't know if it's a column or a book or a essay or a pamphlet or something, called The Power of Procrastination.
I can't wait. Actually, I guess I'll have to wait.
You'll have to wait. Yeah, that's the whole point. And leaders of tomorrow. Procrastinators. but basically, I've tried tasks 10 times at least, where I'm like, I'm going to use tasks. I'm going to change everything. I'm going to go use tasks. It makes sense. It's logical. And then I just don't like it. Like as Stacy was saying, it's just something about it. I just don't like it. I've tried using Keep. I've tried using a gazillion apps and extensions and lots of things. And now what I use is I simply use the snooze feature of Gmail. So I try to do everything as late as possible. And this has provided a structure around my workload. And I basically just go through my inbox and I'm like, hey, I don't have to do that till, you know, April, you know, and off it goes. And this isn't due until Friday. I need like a couple hours. So let me put this at 2 hours before end of day Friday. And so I push everything off into the future. And I'm kind of like juggling all these things in the air. But man, out of sight, out of mind. It's like so nice. So if anybody is inclined in that direction, it's a great way to achieve the zero inbox. You have all these tasks that have to be done, but they're off into the netherworld of the snooze feature in Gmail, and it's really working for me.
I do the same thing, except I have what's called the BS hour, and it's Fridays because that's my light day. So I schedule the time on my calendar, and I go through
schedule. Is that what it is? Beer and scotch hour.
Beer and scotch. Yes, it's the beer and scotch. Okay. It's the hour. It's where I deal with all the bullshit stuff I don't want to deal with.
Is an hour enough? Honestly, when you said that, I thought that's the hour you get to do what you want. And the rest of the time is when you do the BS.
It's okay. Right. So it's about 2 hours, but if it doesn't get done in that first hour and something more enticing happens, I'm on that. So everything again is boomerang or slept or whatever it is that happens then. And I love it. It's doing so well by me.
That's good. And you just get rid of all that stuff. No one ever wants to do in 1 hour. The phone calls. I had a call.
Oh, no, it's only for email.
It's just email. Okay. But it could be phone calls.
No.
Right? No?
No.
You don't have phone calls you don't want to do?
I don't make phone calls.
Well, that's one solution. Just don't do
it. I'm serious. I'm like, I think I've called like...
I had a call to get salt delivered the other day for our water softener.
Oh, my husband deals with all of that. I'm terrible at it.
Yeah, I am too.
I don't know.
You make use of the forward feature of email. Yeah. Forward to husband. Problem solved.
Has anybody found a good replacement for inbox? Anybody? Do either of you use inbox?
I don't like inbox. I never did. So
I use both.
Weird.
Yeah, I use both depending on my mood, depending on what I wanted to do. But over time, I'm not crying because they, you know, I'm not sad because they are killing. I would have been really sad if they killed Gmail. I kind of liked Gmail better because there's more control. It has an all mail folder, which that's not a gender reference. I mean, all the mail, you know, the replies and all that kind of stuff. And so I like that feature if I don't trust that my filters have properly put things in the right place. I can just go to all mail. You can go in and individually create rules much more easily. So I like Gmail a lot. But I do know a lot of people who loved inbox and are very sad that it's going away, despite the fact that they've added some of those features to Gmail.
I gave up on Gmail about a year ago, and I just use an IMAP. But as you said, Mike, I'm terrible at email. What did you mean when you said that?
What I mean is that when people send you email,
you ignore
it. The chance that you're going to see it and reply within the next hour.
Oh no,
is not going to happen.
No.
I mean that's not so. It's but I mean you must get just pounded with email.
I get a lot of email.
Yeah.
I think, because I haven't really opened my inbox.
Who knows? Just assuming.
You know, it might be by now. I don't get any email. I don't really know.
Yeah.
I'm not going to do any more. That's the Google changelog. That's all there is. We're going to have to start a new Google Death Watch is the new.
Yeah.
Is there anything else that we haven't covered that we should cover before we get our picks of the week in here?
Well, wow, really?
I'll tell you what, I'll do an ad, and then if I've skipped anything you really wanted to talk about, you could bring it up. Otherwise, your picks are next. I know you're waiting. You're ready for queso and mole.
I'm like, I am my husband. I'm like, mole tonight.
Stacy isn't admitting it, but actually she calls this show the BS Hour. So,
no, this is the BS 2 to 3 hours.
Yes, yes, yes. It's long, long, long.
Twibs.
It's fun.
Welcome to the BS Hour, episode 500.
We wanted to make it the beer and scotch hour.
That's different. Our show today brought to you by Thousand Eyes, which is so inappropriately named. It should be a million eyes. Thousand Eyes is amazing. What an incredible company. Get an immediate, unmatched view of all the networks and dependencies. Let me step back. I have to explain that this is for people who live in the cloud. If you have a business that uses the cloud for storage, for delivery of content, for apps, if your stuff is in the cloud, and nowadays I think most businesses have at least some stuff in the cloud, you need Thousand Eyes because there's a reason why we draw the cloud as just this puffy little cloud up there. It's a black box. Stuff goes in and you hope it comes out in a timely fashion, but it often doesn't. And it's very, you know, hard to see what's going on there in that puffy little cloud unless you have Thousand Eyes. With Thousand Eyes, you can get an immediate, unmatched view of all the networks and dependencies that impact your user's digital experience because it's awesome. They have eyes everywhere. There's Thousand Eyes' unique path visualization technology extends beyond any boundaries. You can see, understand, and improve the experience for all your apps, services, and websites. Most IT departments can basically, most sensors basically see what's on your network, and as soon as it leaves your network, it's like, well, I hope it gets there. But Thousand Eyes has a massive array of vantage points spanning both the public and the private internet, cloud providers, right down to the Wi-Fi in your local coffee shop, it can see everything. It's as if you've been looking through a smudged windshield, just covered with mud, and trying to peer through it and figure out what's going on. And a squeegee just, and it's crystal clear. You can see it all. Everybody who works in the cloud knows that there are times where you just go, I don't know what's going on. And the boss comes and you say, I know we're losing money, boss. I know the people aren't working or whatever. And we're trying to figure it out, but we just can't see into that puffy little cloud. Now you can. I can't tell you how valuable this is. Regain control. Ensure the best possible digital experience for your employees, for your customers, for you. Make sure you're in the right cloud. That's another thing Thousand Eyes can tell you. If the content you want to deliver should be in that cloud, if you're connected to the right SaaS instance, you can see issues before they impact your customers and employees with Thousand Eyes. And they have great white papers and information. I've learned so much about why, you know, things don't work or do work. This is why top banks, enterprises, SaaS companies, the world's largest and fastest growing brands rely on Thousand Eyes software to do the cloud and do it right. ThousandEyes.com/twit. Get a demo. Find out more. And for your boss, you can get the exclusive ebook on 5 cloud migration challenges you shouldn't ignore. Lots of information at a higher level for people about that cloud migration. I know everybody's considering it. We're all moving to the cloud. If the cloud is important to you now or going to be important to your future, ThousandEyes.com/twit. Do the cloud right. ThousandEyes.com/twit. It's thousand spelled out. ThousandEyes.com/twit. Thousand Eyes. Thrive in a connected world. I'm really pleased to be partnering with them. They're just a really great company. All right, Stacy, did you see anything that we didn't cover?
Nope. I'm going mole. Mole.
At this point, she says, I don't care if there's something in there. How about you, Mike? Anything important? Do you want to keep this woman from her mole?
No, I do not. I would never stand between the woman and her mole.
Stacy, do you have a thing? I have one more thing for you to do.
I do.
Yes.
I was typing them in, but I typed them in badly. So I am planning to drive myself, my daughter, and my dog up to Seattle. So I've been trusting and playing with road trip apps. And since we are actually, it is spring break now.
So just the two of you are going to drive together? That's so cute.
Well, the dog too.
Well, of course.
Okay. She's like another person. She has opinions and everything.
She's going to be sitting she's going to be sitting shotgun.
No, she'll be in the backseat.
Okay.
The daughter gets shotgun. Road Trippers is the first app. There's two, and I'm still up in the air on which one I like. There's features on each that I like. And the other is Furkot. I don't know how to say it. F-U-R-K-O-T.
Furkot.
I don't know what that's about.
Furkot. Miss the turns on your terms. Ooh, I like this idea.
So what's neat there is you can actually tell it a lot of things, like where you're going, but also like how much you want to drive, when do you want to start? And it's a lot more detailed. So if you really want to and then Road Trippers is really nice because it shows you like parks and things like that. And I like both of them because you get like your total drive time. You get like estimates on.
You used to have to go to AAA and get a map with a magic marker on it for this.
Yeah. And like this Road Trippers like estimates your gas costs and that sort of thing.
This is great.
So yeah, I was really excited. I think both of these are, so far I've experienced them as the free app. They're both high quality. I haven't taken the road trip yet. So,
have you ever done a cross country trip?
No, I haven't.
This is gonna be so much fun.
Yeah, I've driven to New Orleans a couple times, and I've driven to Tallahassee. Don't ask me why.
Now I want to ask you why.
I'm just for fun.
Now this is going to be what a great mother daughter and dog thing to do. I think this is great.
Yeah,
you're
going to
see things like the giant ball of yarn and stuff like that, right?
We're actually focused on, I think we're going to go see like the Grand Canyon. We're going to take some detours. We're going to Marfa first, so Austin to Marfa. And then possibly somewhere in the middle, then maybe the Grand Canyon. And then we're going to drive through like the Columbia River Gorge. I'm trying to convince myself that I want to go to the Escalante National Park in Utah. But that's also kind of like a lot.
There really isn't a whole lot to do in Kansas except to go to Cocker City and see the world's largest ball of twine. I'm just saying.
Oh, we're skipping Kansas. We're skipping. Kansas is not on the agenda.
Oh, come on. You know you want to see this.
Nope. I do.
I think Mike
should do
a gastro-nomad adventure in Cocker City.
The twine experience.
The twine experience. There's lots to see.
That sounds awesome, Stacey. That sounds absolutely incredible.
Especially
that app sounds great.
Since the world's largest twine ball is pungent with the smell of moist twine decay.
Gross! Gross!
That's the review from roadsideamerica.com.
Oh. Yeah, you don't have to go there. You can smell it from Utah.
We went to, we were in Maine and we did a roadside attraction. It was the world's largest chocolate mousse. And I will tell you, it was pretty good.
It's fun to see these. It's kind of tradition. All right. Well, enjoy. I think that sounds like a great idea. Mr. Michael Elgin, your pick of the week.
As you know, I'm obsessed with GANs, which are generative adversarial networks.
Me too.
Yes. I think this is the most promising technology for the future of fake everything we've ever come up with. It's basically a machine learning technique that's been around for about 4 or 5 years, which can generate fake data. It can generate fake words, fake images, fake videos, fake this, fake that. We're all familiar with deep fakes. Those are generated with GANs. So basically, you throw a bunch of real data at this machine learning system. One of them, and there are two machine learning systems. One takes the real data and tries to imitate it with fake data, lots and lots and lots of fake data, throws it the other one, which is the discriminator, which judges that data based on how good it is compared with the real sample. And then the original one goes back to the drawing board, tries again, does it better this time, and both the discriminator and the generator get better and better and better until you get fake data that looks completely real. Now, we've seen that this person does not exist before, and then somebody came out with this cat does not exist. This is cats made with, you know, artificial cats made with this technology. And now there's a website, and this is my obsession of the week, called This X Does Not Exist. So somebody has started to curate all the goofy GAN related websites that people are throwing out there. This rental does not exist is one of them. It's a fake Airbnb listings. This waifu does not exist. I'm not sure what a waifu is. I'm not really. This startup does not exist. So they're creating those startup websites that we've all seen that are all very similar.
Oh, I gotta go to that. Wait a minute. This is GAN created. Here's one. Premescent. Using AI in fashion, and it's got a nice picture of a fox. Meet the team of Premescent. Get to know the heads behind Premescent, or even better, become a Premescent. Masana Lafour, the CCO. Shalene Claps, the COO. Douglas Domena, the CEO. Premescent is more than just blockchain. Funding, calling, and startup are just a few characteristics of Premescent, but we offer a lot more. Fearless, euphorically, irresistibly, Premescent is like Google, but for fashion. This is auto generated. This is brilliant.
This is
brilliant. Oh,
I think that over
God.
Time, this site will be populated by lots and lots and lots of examples of some of them better than others of GAN generated. Fake data and images and videos and everything. And I think that'll be very healthy for us to pay attention and like see what is being produced so that we can dial up our skepticism about the images and words and sites and everything that were presented. Because the problem with this kind of thing is that when you can create fake anything at scale,
yeah,
then, and let me give you another example that we don't talk about, because I wrote about how this technology could be used to crack security. There's a GAN that can actually crack fingerprint readers, the kind that you have in your smartphone. And here's how it works. Basically, fingerprint scanners don't scan the whole fingerprint. They scan little chunks of it and lots of little parts of it to see these patterns that are unique to each person. However, there are some snippets of these fingerprints that are more common than others. And so somebody used GANs to create thousands and thousands and thousands of fake fingerprint snippets that are most likely to pass as real snippets. And then they're combined in all these different variations. And so it's essentially a brute force attack on fingerprint readers, where they throw thousands of these snippets at until they get one to unlock the device. And of course, this can happen very quickly with, you know, fast computers. It's a brute force attack, just like a password attack, but you can do it with fingerprints now, thanks to this technology. So there's lots and lots of ways that this general method can be used to do things they're not supposed to be able to do. They just have absolutely destroy CAPTCHAs. And so, which is ironic, because the whole point of a CAPTCHA is to prove you're human. Turns out machines are better at proving they're human than people are.
Oh, of course they are. Wow.
Anyway, this X does not exist.
I love it.
Check it out.
This was our 500th episode. If you've been listening continuously since episode one, you've listened for 37 days, 7 hours, 17 minutes, and 52 seconds.
Time well spent.
I don't know about that, but it's better than 2 hours of BS. That's all I can say. Thank you.
That's your life, Leo.
That's your
Not
life.
Not BS. Hours spent on Twig. Wow.
That's a lot of hours. Thank you, Stacey Higginbotham, for spending about 20 days of that with us. Stacey on IoT.com, at GigaStacey on Twitter, and don't forget her great podcast with Kevin Toefel, all about IoT. Enjoy your mole, Stacey.
Mole.
And from Mexico City, the peripatetic Mike Elgin. He's our digital nomad, digitalnomad.net. You can also, gastronomad.net is the place to go to find out about their events. There is a space opening in Mexico City in just a few days. Last chance.
Send me an email, mike@elgin.com. And if you want to go, because just a stroke of good luck that is available.
Gastronomad.net if you want to learn more. This, and click the experiences button. That's going to be so much fun. Can I, if I looked over that balcony behind you, Mike, would I see the Zocalo?
You would not. We are not in the location yet because it's pretty expensive. But this is an apartment we rent whenever we're in Mexico City. And it's a view of a kind of an average street in a vaguely posh neighborhood. It's not bad.
Sounds exciting.
Yeah, but the apartment itself is great and has good Wi-Fi and all that kind of stuff.
Oh, so that's awesome. Yeah, it was great. Thank you so much for joining us from Mexico
Thank
City.
You.
Thanks to all of you. Episode 500 is almost done. We appreciate your being here. We do This Week in Google every Wednesday afternoon, 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern, 20:30 UTC. You can watch live or listen live at twit.tv/live. If you do that, chat away at irc.twit.tv. And of course, you can always get on-demand versions of our shows at twit.tv/twig or subscribe in your favorite podcast application to get every single episode. Thank you, everybody. We'll see you next week for episode 501 of This Week in Google. Bye-bye.